is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
A look at the indomitable women who fought their way into some of the best defended male monopolies in the U.S. labor force, the skilled trades of New York City. Then Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Indy Mac, Bear Stearns, and Lehman Brothers. We've been treated to the failure of more major financial firms than during any year since the Great Depression. What's the fallout for us, and what is to be done? Now, Jane Latour, and Jane is a journalist with the Public Employees Press and a labor activist who managed the Women's Project of the Association for Union Democracy, one of my favorite organizations. She joins us now for a synopsis of her new book, Sisters in the Brotherhoods, Working Women Organizing for Equality in New York City. Such an important book, and I'm sorry, I couldn't help but think about it, Jane, in contrast to the superficiality that has unfolded within the context of the presidential election as to what constitutes a kind of glass ceiling for women and who represents the interests of women. Well, here's this stunning book, and I want to begin with, first of all, what are the jobs that women are actually excluded from in terms of the working class?
Well, I would say underrepresented, because one thing that we really paid attention to after 9/11, 7 years ago, was the fact that women are in every job, in every blue-collar job that men do. Women were at ground zero doing every single job. They were repairing the telephones. They were women iron workers. There were women carpenters. There were women firefighters. There were women in the rescue services. All of these jobs are jobs that women are still non-traditional, meaning that the Department of Labor, when they count the figures, that women are well under 25%, and that makes them non-traditional. So there are a lot of jobs that women are still very underrepresented in, and that was the idea behind this book, to look at these jobs and the history of women entering these jobs and to say, why are the numbers still so low?
Let's do that. Look at why the numbers are so low and what the role of the organized labor movement has been within that context in management.
You know, I think that basically in the book, everybody gets a black eye, because in 1978, the Department of Labor and President Jimmy Carter put some new regulations into effect. That was after a long struggle by the women's movement, who put some real teeth into the affirmative action and the equal employment opportunity, hiring opportunities that came about because of Title VII and the Civil Rights Act. So there was a long, hard fight, and then Carter put these regulations in effect, and women really started coming into these jobs. Now, at that point, the labor movement was a lot stronger compared to where we are now. And a lot of the unions, instead of embracing, not all of the unions, but a lot of the unions, for example, the unions representing the firefighters and in the communication workers, CWA, Local 1101, which is where the craft technical jobs were, these unions were very concerned about protecting the job for the members that they were already representing. The unions could have, you know, embraced and opened up their doors, but it was a real struggle. And the women really had to make a place for themselves, and they had to try to find a home in the unions. All of the stories in my book are about people organizing together to try to get real representation.
Now, against what you've said, the backdrop, is it primarily an individualized breaking into these non-traditional jobs for women? Or is there still some broader collective institutionalized effort to penetrate these resistant job titles that women are clearly equipped to perform and to do?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because there is still an organized presence to represent the women, because, as I say in the book, and I try to show, that women are still having a lot of difficulties because the numbers are still so low that oftentimes women work in isolation. And so there are so few of them, so they still have a lot of issues. Now, things have changed tremendously, but basically the conversation hasn't changed in 30 years. to quote somebody from a group that is still out there. The group Legal Momentum in New York City, which used to be called Now Legal Defense and Education Fund, is doing terrific work on this project. And they just issued 2 weeks ago a report called From the Ground Up, Building Opportunities for Women in Construction. And their report is based on a fabulous conference that they held last year where they had people from every part of, you know, they had city government, unions, and the women themselves. And they tried to look at all of the issues that are still barriers for women. So they are doing this work, and they do it in many different ways. And they're actually, they have a great website where people could read about the work they do. It's just www.legalmomentum.org. And also some of the women who were at the book party at NYU, you know, they're still carrying on the tradition of women organizing. So, for example, I've never attended their meetings, but I know that there's a group of elevator women, women who are trained to be mechanics. And like we said, they're still, 30 years later, they're still really pioneers out there on the blue-collar frontier because there's so few of them. But they are organizing, they are meeting together. And then there's a whole national group called TNT, Tradeswomen Now and Tomorrow.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, we love that. And they have a national group with board members from around the country. And in fact, I'm very proud to say that the Women's Project of Association for Union Democracy was one of the founding mothers of that group. And we sent a wonderful tradeswoman, a pioneer in the IBEW Local 3, Evan Bruderman, to attend all those meetings. We have tradeswoman representation there, and I did attend some of those meetings. They actually have been very successful in getting the ear of the building trades and the building trades department in the AFL-CIO, and it only took 30 years, but they have actually really now started to represent the fact that women are in the trades and serve as a conduit and a source of information and to invite them to their meetings, and it's great progress.
And one of the things that I love about the book, which I've actually just got a copy of and haven't even had a chance to really break the cover yet, but just scanning it, there are, and I love this, interviews, and there's the oral histories of women who have broken into the building trades in New York City over several decades now. And so it's in their voice, and it has a human face along with an intellectual character in substance that just makes it exciting to even begin to think about reading. And I'm interested in about the process of preparing that book and getting folks together for that purpose.
I started interviewing these women back when I was at AUD in 1989-1990. And what happened, you know, AUD is a national group, and we got calls from women from all over the country. And one of the things that I always heard was, I am in the union and I'm trying to get, but I'm not getting representation. So I heard these stories from all over. But I was working with women closely in New York City. AUD has always had a strong presence in the building trades. So I was meeting these women who I saw were organizing, doing terrific work. And one of the things women across the country would say to me, I can't do anything until we have more women in the union. And I thought, wrong. So I started to interview women, going and taking my notebook out to the airport to meet with them or here and there. And then I started taping them. And that turned into this project that I just kept trying to document. What happened is that their voices are so compelling and over time, and it just turned into the fact that, you know, we need to have a book to tell these stories. Because what I always see about interviewing workers, whether it's for the public employee press or as, you know, an advocate for the women, is that they are the best witnesses. They've been there, and they see and know what they're talking about in a way that nobody else can know. And I thought, there's a lot of oral histories out there now about women in blue-collar, non-traditional jobs, but I really wanted to show, being that I come from an orientation of great commitment to union democracy through AUD and the great experience of working for them, and really understanding all the issues of corruption, discrimination, lack of democracy. So I thought that these women could represent these issues with real depth and context and really explain why is it that you can have a law and you can have it on the books, but that it's still so little enforcement of that law. What does that mean in reality when an individual worker shows up on the job site to get a job? what's that reality?
Well, Jane, we will have you back and discuss the book more comprehensively and do some readings for it, but I did want folks, particularly in the context of what's been discussed about women's interests lately,
yes,
to deal with the reality of women's interests and women's efforts and accomplishments, and of course, work that is still to be done, genuine, real work that unfortunately is not really on the agenda. And you've helped put it there, and you've always done that with your work. And I strongly recommend that people get this new book by Jane Latour, Sisters in the Brotherhoods, Working Women Organizing for Equality in New York City. Thank you very much for all that you do.
Thank you, Mimi.
We have plowed and we have planted. We have gathered into barns, done the same work as the men, with babies in our arms. But you won't find our stories in most history books you read. We were there. We're still here, fighting for the things we need. We were there in the factories. We were there in the mills. We were there in the mine and came home to fix the meals. We were there on the picket line. We raised our voices loud. It makes me proud just knowing. Textile mills in Lawrence, to the sweatshops in New York, from the fields in California, where our children had to work. We fought to make a living.
Bread and roses was our pride.
Though they jailed and beat our bodies,
our spirit never died.
Well, before you heard the name Sarah Palin, my goodness, we were there, yes, fighting to get into all those edifices which we were kept out of, but we were there. And again, I would strongly recommend that you get Jane Latour's book just to see how far we've gone and what we still have to accomplish as people in the working class. And now, well, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Indie Mac, Bear Stearns, sounds like a zoo almost, and Lehman Brothers, we've been treated to the failure of more major financial firms than during any year since the Great Depression. And the question for us really is, what is the fallout and what is to be done? And we're joined by Dr. William Spriggs, Community Economic Development Professor and Chair of the Department of Economics at Howard University. And our job is to wake people up. And I don't know, should I be filled with terror and absolute trepidation? I mean, Barack Obama says, and I dare say it is true, that this is really one of the most dramatic periods in the financial market since the collapse of 1931. How ominous is it?
This is the biggest challenge we have faced since the Great Depression, by far. Doesn't mean we're going to have a Great Depression at all, but it means the greatest challenge we have faced since then. And because it is a market failure, people want to paint this as simply greed or paint it simply as people getting loans they shouldn't have gotten. Yes, that's some of it. And we do need market regulation. And if we had market regulation, some of this might not have happened. But for all those who believe that the market always works and gets you the right solution and we can just rely on the market, no, this is one of those times where the market has failed, and that's why it is such a big issue. Because a market failure is a big issue. If it were just some greedy people, you know, we went through Enron. We've gone through greed and firms acting improperly. That doesn't bring down a whole system. The problem we are faced with is that we had a housing bubble. Mortgages represent one third of all the domestic debt in the United States. Mortgages amount to about $11 trillion worth of debt. Out of the total debt in the United States, just to put mortgage debt into perspective, the federal debt, which everybody screams and hollers about, is $5.3 trillion. So mortgage debt is almost twice the debt that the federal government owes, the total debt of the federal government. So if housing prices drop by 20% like they did this year, then mortgages are backed by the value of homes. If those housing values drop by 20%, that means that those mortgages intrinsically are worth a lot less if they were revalued according to the drop in, you know, what's backing them by that 20%. You're talking about sort of a $2 trillion problem that's working its way through the economy. That's going to affect a lot of things, and that's where we see it happen. The write-downs we saw earlier by Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, and others, and now we see that it's actually caught firms like Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, and we see the federal government stepped in on AIG to strike a deal to essentially take a big stake in AIG.
Well, you know, it seems like there's an $85 billion bridge loan that by the central bank, the Federal Reserve. In effect, it looks like they've been nationalized. Might that actually wind up being a good thing?
Well, it shows the dimension of the problem. Again, when the market fails, then the government has to step in. This is so ironic because, of course, we had the Bush administration, and McCain had joined in on the idea that we should privatize Social Security. But it's precisely the moment we are living in right now why you cannot privatize Social Security, because markets do fail. And when they fail on this scale, if you had privatized Social Security, then everybody would be up the creek, and we would be stepping in as we are now, except it would have to be stepping in on the side of little folks. And all of what's going on, you haven't seen the government yet step in on the side of little folks. All those mortgages represent individual homeowners, and those homeowners are going through a record foreclosure rate. And, you know, Senator Obama has a plan that includes money for localities to try and deal with the foreclosure crisis. Senator McCain hasn't put forth anything at all to talk about what to do with individuals.
Actually, would you say that McCain's fingerprints are on a lot of this? I mean, after all, he was involved with the savings and loan debacle and scandals, and his chief advisor, Phil Graham.
It's amazing how McCain's record with the Keating debacle doesn't get brought up now. So I'm glad you brought that up because, yes, it is sort of this pattern that markets are okay and we can have sort of the wild, wild west going on all the time. And now he wants us to believe that he sees the light. Well, it's a little too late. And, of course, it's always amazing. He says he wants a commission. This debacle is the time for action. It's not the time for study and being contemplative. We're going through this right now, and we don't want it to spread and get worse. That's why the Fed stepped in on AIG. They were fearful that if AIG were allowed to collapse, then other parts of the system would start to fall apart.
Might that not still be the case with Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, who look like they're teetering on the brink?
Well, Goldman does not have the exposure to the mortgage market that the others do. The issue with Bear Stearns was that they had an important role with some of the insurance side of bonding. And so they didn't want Bear Stearns to fail. Lehman didn't have that same type of relationship, but we may see some fallout from people who had unsecured debt with Lehman. Everybody, of course, now is claiming they don't, and you see flashes of rumors about who's linked. Not linked to Lehman, but at the moment, the firms that got out of the mortgage market earlier, like Goldman, seem to be holding up.
So for us little guys, what next? What happens to us. Is this a time where we collectively say there must be the kind of regulation that, frankly, even the Clinton administration with Glass-Steagall, the deregulation they went through, is that what this is really mandating for us to do?
It's mandating for us to get back into the marketplace and to regulate the market, precisely because the market can get it wrong, as it did this time. Yes, some of it was greed, but when housing prices are going up and people are making money on housing going up, the market is going to get it wrong, because every signal in the market is going to be this consensus that value of homes are rising enough to back the activity that we saw. We can say it was reckless. If we had had regulation in place, we would have slowed it down. If the Fed had been doing its job, the bubble would not have been as widespread. It would have made sure that we didn't have the improper loans that went into place. But you have mentioned this before. The huge trade deficit that we run with China, and the fact that China has trillions of dollars that just float around in the financial market, is also part of this. Because with that money being out there and needing to be invested, the Chinese hit upon, why don't we do, instead of U.S. Treasury notes, which have a very low rate of return, why don't we go into the mortgage market? And they started buying up Fannie Mae paper. So it's a little more than just the greed side of it. If the households in America had seen their incomes rise with the productivity of American workers, we wouldn't have seen the debt problem that we have. Americans would have been paying off their debt. This would not, we would have gone into debt. So we had a weird model going. The last 8 years showed that model in the raw, when today we have median household income lower than in 2000. So people are worse off in terms of their median income. We floated the whole economy by letting people borrow money. And we had the Bush administration watch as household debt went up and up and up. They watched as mortgage debt went up and up and up. And no one said, how is this going to work out? If people aren't making more money, how are we letting them run up this debt?
Well, I so wish you were the head of the Department of Labor. And not that there's any problem with being the chair of the Department of Economics at Howard University, but just in tandem with that. So let's for a moment just pretend that you are, and what needs to be done? What is the plan that the working class really can rally around in this very grave and bleak economic period?
Well, you know, this is one of the frustrations I have had in watching the reporting on the whole campaign. There are specific things that can happen to correct the fall in relationship between productivity of workers and their wages. Senator Obama has been very specific on these things. One is, of course, he can't keep having this policy of no minimum wage. We ran that experiment in the 1980s with Ronald Reagan, and since then we've had this difficulty in getting the minimum wage back up. Once and for all, we got to get the minimum wage up, and it just needs to be indexed so that we don't go through these battles all the time to make sure that the wage floor moves with productivity. Wages need to move with productivity. And then we need to make sure that workers have a voice at the table, and we have to change the way that we do labor organizing. We have to have a freedom of choice for workers to actually choose to become members of unions so that we put the voice of workers back into the system. It hasn't worked to take the workers out of the voice, and we've seen that again and again where we have recoveries, but wages are slow to catch up. This just doesn't work. So those are two super key elements, which are things we know work, and the cynicism that people have either in thinking, oh, the candidates aren't speaking about specifics, or that there aren't things the government can do that can work, doesn't help us in this election. People have to know, yes, policies matter, and yes, there are candidates who are talking about specific issues.
Well, Dr. Spriggs, you're my candidate, certainly, for elevation to the Department of Labor, but certainly, if not that, at this juncture, the fact is that you really do enlighten us and provide us with analysis and give us some place to move rather than lapsing into the malaise of depression, no puns intended. And I thank you very much.
Well, thanks, because my current job isn't a bad job at all. I really like it. So.
Are the Howard students, like, really into this?
They are paying attention to this election very much. And they're paying attention to the economy, of course, with great attention, because they can see that if the, for everyone, you know, if this liquidity problem stays, that is, if the financial sector stays weak, then their ability to buy homes, they're worried about their future. What about their ability to buy homes? Will there be money readily available for them? And what about their student loans?
Precisely. Well, Dr. William Spriggs, thank you for joining us. And Dr. Spriggs is the Community Economic Development Professor and Chair of the Department of Economics at Howard University and a good friend of this station. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to thank you for listening. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report.